Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm the director of training here in the North Carolina office, sometimes referred to as the Firebase. And guys, I'm really excited for this podcast because I have a guest on here who's a friend who's one of my former instructors. And normally when people hear like, oh, former instructor, they're thinking like, oh, this is one of the guys that like Kevin brought up through the ranks and you know, is now working under Kevin at Fieldcraft, like whether it's Jerry or Jared out in Washington or whoever. But no, when I say my former instructor, or I should say current instructor, because I'm still a student. This is a guy who I trained under at Gunsight a few years back. I've seen him multiple times, you know, at Gunsight, follow him online. And I'll tell you something, you know, my firearms background, I don't come from the law enforcement community or the military community. I always say whenever I take a class, I come from the armed civilian community of two decades, right? Like that's my experience. But this gentleman brings a lot of information to the table, a lot of experience. And I always learn something whenever I talk to him or I follow him or read his posts, and I think you're going to enjoy him. So with that being said, I want to introduce Eric Gelhaus. Eric, like I said, was one of my instructors at Gunsight and has a background in the military and law enforcement and is now one of the premier firearms instructors. And I'm going to blow up his head by saying premier firearm instructors because I really think he is. And I think you're going to learn a lot from him in the following podcast. So Eric, good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning, Kevin. How are you?
Not too bad. Did that introduction, you know, did that like stroke the ego a little bit? Did it help you out?
A little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
A little bit too. Yeah. Yes. I appreciate it.
You know, it's kind of like when you go into a grappling tournament and you see that the class that you're in is either masters or executive, but all that really means is that you're old, you know? So when someone says like premier instructor, like I really do mean that. Like, I really do think you're one of the best in the biz. But yeah, I'm always one to flatter first. So,
and I am old.
Oh, come on. You're not as old as some of the folks I've seen on shooting ranges. But you're definitely my senior. So I will respect my elders. And I don't know, I'm just not going to continue with this explanation of why I gave the intro. So let's just jump right into it. Let's talk, kind of give a quick bio. And then I got some like real pointed questions for you. So why should people, or I should say, what should people know about you?
So I do bring the combination of prior military career, law enforcement, and decent normal human stuff to my teaching. Military-wise, I was conventional combat arms. I did a stint as a support guy in a fun organization, and then back to conventional combat arms. So I did my deployment over to the Global War on Terror as a heavy weapons squad leader. 29 years in law enforcement, after the military, after working on an ambulance and doing some search and rescue stuff, but kind of did the full gamut, patrol, gangs, narcotics, a lot of teaching in there, both patrol skills and use of force. I was fortunate in the early 2000s, I got asked to come on staff at Gunsight, and I've been there ever since. And about the time I retired, I kind of had to spawn up my own company for as a place to park some teaching stuff I was doing. And so I still do teaching with that, and that's Cougar Mountain Solutions. Been a writer, and what was cool was doing the dive into the academic world. So went off to grad school towards the end of the law enforcement career, and that kind of gives a nerd perspective on some of the stuff I do.
You're a brave man for calling your company Cougar Mountain. I know Florida. Yes. Florida doesn't have mountains, but if you're trying to find cougars, you got to go to Sarasota. Apparently that's the highest population of cougars. And I only know this because a friend of mine had a destination wedding there and he said, watch out for cougars. But where does Cougar Mountain come from?
So it's, you know, the funny thing is that side of it never even entered my mind when I put it together. It's a terrain feature in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's kind of at the south end of the county I was born and raised in.
Oh, okay.
If anybody's a NASCAR fan and they've watched any of the races at Sears Point, the backside of Sears Point Raceway is Cougar Mountain. Had spent a bunch of time down there, not at the racetrack, in the aftermath of an event. And it just had a lot to do with letting me burn off energy. Mm-hmm. Let the mind work while I was burning off mental energy and stuff. So when I went to flip the switch and name the company, that was kind of what stuck into my head, was that place.
Got it. All right. Now getting to your experience as an instructor, I recently was asked in a email that I received Do you train up instructors? And my first response was, have you ever been one of my students? You know, because I don't think, or have you ever been a student in general? Because a lot of people want to just jump from, say, like an interest into becoming an instructor. But I think some of the best instructors are students first. Do you recall the first firearms course that you ever attended that was not your, say, basic safety course?
So it was years before I took a basic safety course. It was more just to go take it. Mm-hmm. My first exposure to firearms was basic training. I didn't grow up shooting. So then probably the next one would after that would be the police academy. Because everything I got pre-police academy was all in the military.
Okay. And how have things changed? Because you've been in this industry for quite some time. So from that initial training at the or I should say in the military and then in the police academy, how have things changed? Like, what are the greatest advancements? I mean, what do you see as something that, wow, I can't believe we taught that back in the day to, you know, this is how it should be taught today?
We've got a better understanding of human factors mm-hmm. and how they play into what we do. I think we've got a better understanding, most of the community, on how adults learn. And the different ways to reach adults, and I'm not just talking the tactile, visual, or audio, auditory. We've just got a better handle on how to teach adults and how we can get them to learn. I see less rote stuff, rote memorization. Now, it's one thing when you're teaching a basic training company, and you've got 150, 200. People that you have no idea what the baseline is, and you've all got to mm-hmm. get into a minimum standard, take that out of it. But I think in the decent, normal human side of things, we just got a better way of understanding how to present the material, how to get it across, and how folks learn it.
Is there a red flag that you could kind of point out to anyone that's a student, whether they're a student at like a prestigious institution or kind of like you're learning from your uncle or whoever? Is there a red flag when it comes to an instructor where, you know, you just said like avoid rote memorization, but what is your biggest red flag that you could point out to someone if you said like you should find a better instructor?
The way after issues of safety, the way versus a way. Mm-hmm. You were talking about, you know, students and teaching and instructor stuff. One of the classes I do is a pistol mounted optics instructor class, and I got a chance to run it in a hybrid version, which was both law enforcement and decent normal human beings that wanted to teach or wanted to know how to teach the dot. And there was a lot of time spent like, look, yes, here is a way, here is another way, here is a third way. And it's not that any one of these is any better. While I may have my preferences, that second and third way is how you may end up reaching somebody or finding a way that works for them. So it's take the opportunity to learn from others and learn different ways. And if it's something that's not the way I was taught, right, but that works, or I can see how that would work for somebody else, then grab it and use it, because you may need that to reach the next student. It's like the vocabulary stuff, right? If I tried to talk to everybody in the vocabulary that I used as a cop, I would miss a lot of my decent, normal human students, right? But I also can't talk to my law enforcement students the way I could talk to guys in the military. Mm-hmm. You just got to know the different languages, and you got to know the different techniques, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, I recently took a class where there was another, I know you're a lefty, so there's another lefty in this class, and the instructor demonstrated, as all good instructors should, demonstrated the technique with his left hand. And he said, this is the instructor speaking. He goes, I use my middle finger. If the pistol does not have an ambidextrous magazine release, he goes, I use my middle finger to drop the magazine because I feel like that finger is stronger. And this one gentleman who was in the class, who was a sheriff, a SWAT guy from North Carolina, he said, I always have been using my index finger, you know, for finding that magazine release. He's like, it's going to be a hard time for me to do that. And the instructor was very clear. And he said, just do you, boo, right? That was his expression. Yeah. He goes, do you, boo, whatever works for you. That's what I want you to do. As long as you can do it safely and it's efficient and it's effective, he goes, do that. But I agree with you on that one. There are some folks who, when they put out that, you know, you're going to do it this way. There's only one way. It almost creates that, that like handcuffed mind. Like you can't look, yes. You can't look around the corner. You can't, you know, you must do it our way. And then, you know, like there's no doubt, like in the shooting world, the tactical guys have knowledge of tactics based on situations. And then the competitive shooters have knowledge of efficiency because they have to do things not necessarily quicker, but smoother and sooner. And these two worlds don't see eye to eye. And they, many times it's like, you can't associate with them. You can't associate with these guys. Like, and that's just, I think that's a terrible way to look at things. Like learn from anyone. So I'm with you on that one. Now you get the call eventually to join the Gunsight community as an instructor. But what was your first experience at Gunsight? Because I think everyone remembers the first time that they go through that driveway entranceway. And like everyone else, I stopped and I took the photo of the Raven, and, you know, and I took the photo pretty much every single time looking for that perfect sunrise or sunset photo. But what was your first experience going to Gunsight as a student and then eventually an instructor?
So if I can, I'm going to digress and talk about how I found out about the place.
Yeah, please do.
So I was very fortunate. When I was a baby cop, the county I was born and raised in and worked in suddenly realized we had a gang problem. And so we were sending guys down to Los Angeles to go to gang school to learn how to identify gangsters and work cases on them. And I was kind of the tail end of that training because I was the new kid. And so they sent me to a class at Los Angeles PD that we thought was how to identify gangsters. And it turned out to be a tactical training and shooting package class for their gang cops. And here this lone deputy from Northern California shows up. They were great. They took good care of me. But the guy who was the lead instructor for the class kept talking about this place called American Pistol Institute and Jeff Cooper and the Combat Triad, things I hadn't heard of in the police academy. So I'm like, ooh, I got to start paying attention to this place. So a couple of years later, I finally get down there. But right before I went, I had gone to the LA Sheriff's Department gang school and ran into a young lady there who was wearing a Gunsight t-shirt. And I made the mistake, I was younger then, of asking if her boyfriend had gotten that shirt. She puffed up to that all 5'5" and said, no, she'd been through the pistol class and the shotgun class and asked me when I went. And I said, I'm going in 2 weeks. And she goes, oh, you need to ask Bill Jeans these questions. Bill was the operations manager at the time. And proof of how dumb I was, I actually wrote down all the questions she told me to ask. And Monday morning in the classroom, Bill Jeans was up holding court and asked if anybody had any questions. So I pulled out the note card I had and started asking the questions. And he asked me how I knew this young lady. And so I had to tell the whole embarrassing story of that. I was real fortunate. I went through and took my 250 class in the fall of 1994. Had people everywhere from very high-end Department of Energy stuff to two grandmothers from Oklahoma that showed up Monday morning with everything in a big box and asked the instructors like how they put it together. Mm-hmm. Like how do you put the belt, the holster on the belt and everything. Herschel Davis, who was kind of a legend in the SEAL community. Herschel was one of my coaches that week, and he was living in the bunkhouse just outside the gate that a big jewelry family owned at the time. And so that was my first experience coming down. Took several classes. Buzz Mills bought the place in 99 and brought Jeff Cooper back for a series of what they called the master's classes, and took the master's rifle class. It was the first one of the master's classes they had offered. Bob Young, Louie Auerbach, John Ganaway were some of the instructors and coaches. It was after that class that I got the invitation to come on to apprentice and go through the instructor development program there.
No kidding. So it was just one of those things where they just were paying attention and they said, this is the guy. And then they brought you on. And then I'm assuming it was shadowing the instructors, learning the Gunsight methodology, like making sure that you understand the four rules that are posted as you drive in the driveway on the signs and, you know, basically living the Gunsight way. Right.
Yeah. So there's an expectation that you know how to teach already. Mm-hmm. You should have been doing that, whatever, you know, community you're coming from. I was fortunate. I had been teaching for the sheriff's office I worked for at that point for about 7 years. And then they want to make sure you know the material, you know what Gunsight teaches, what we teach, how we work within that system. And then did three classes where I was apprenticing under other Gunsight instructors and range masters. And at the end of that, and there's a humorous story or two over the course of those times. But at the end of that, then I came on staff, paid as a coach. And then in the late 00s, I got a chance to go through the process. We call it a check ride to become a lead instructor or a range master. And so I've been doing both the range master and the coach or the assistant instructor thing ever since.
Fantastic. Yeah. The Gunsight Academy is one of those places that I was really excited for the opportunity to go. And anyone that's listening, I'm going to give a plug to a nonprofit association that you should check into. Look up the Jeff Cooper Legacy Foundation, because I wrote a 500 word essay you're going to know this name. I wrote a 500 word essay and I explained, like, listen, this is how I enjoy the shooting community. This is how I, teach firearms in terms of like the history of them as a history teacher. I believe in firearm safety and whatnot. And next thing you know, I get an email and it's a certified letter. And it said, you've been accepted to the Gunsight 250 course. You must select it for the following year, but it's a $2,000 course and it's over 5 days. You're going to need 1,000 rounds of ammo, da, 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 da. And I was like, oh my gosh, did that really just happen? Did I just spend, say, 30 minutes writing a heartfelt letter about firearms? And did I just want a $2,000 class? So I was really excited because that Legacy Foundation provides scholarships to Gunsight if you just put in a little bit of effort. And to put this into perspective, my sister wrote a letter. She got a course, which she hasn't taken yet. I don't even know if she's interested in it, but she won a course. David Cagle, he got a course. Good friend of mine. Yeah.
Let me jump in. I have had both you and Cagle as students.
Yeah, I know.
So Cagle has a really interesting backstory on what we called the Modern Technique Tour from a couple summers ago. But yeah, I've had Dave as a student. He's a friend.
Yeah. Cagle's awesome. He's a young cop who acts like an old cop and he does it right. And he is technical with everything that he does. So shout out to you, David. And I've been to his house and he's squared away. You know, I love Cagle. Yeah. I mean, when you have a bunkhouse in your personal home for students that just want to come in and train, and the bunkhouse is there just for training, like, you know, the dude's a training junkie, just like me. So Cagle got it. And then Luke Cagle, his brother, got it. And now,
yes,
Here's my exciting part. My buddy, Jerry Young, who is our shotgun instructor here, retired LEO guy. He's been my survival student and co-instructor here since 2006. Jerry just applied. He got it. And now he's on the hunt for a 1911 that he can carry to Gunsight. Because I told him, if you shoot anything but a 1911 at Gunsight as a student of Jeff Cooper, oh, man, I feel like the late colonel would be shedding a tear. Although I know he was a fan of Glocks toward the end. But it just seems like that's the tradition. Like, you got to carry a 1911. So in any case, I got the opportunity to go to Gunsight. That was in August of 2020 in the middle of COVID. And during the middle of COVID, I remember we all had to get our temperatures checked. And of course there's a heat wave. So everyone one day got our temperatures checked and every one of us was like over 100 degrees. And you were like, go over in that shed, stand in the shade for a few minutes. We all sit in the shed and of course we're all normal, right? Like, after we got out of the heat wave and out of the Arizona sun. But I had the greatest time at Gunsight. Like, I felt like a gunslinger. I cleaned my pistol every single night. I camped at the campground. I learned the danger of the pro shop because they don't take your credit card until the very end of the week. I had a chance to visit my buddy Rob Lahey at Simply Rugged, who stocks the Gunsight store with Raven embossed leather that he makes. I mean, it was just such an incredible experience. And the cool thing was I was there as my kind of introduction to Fieldcraft. And I remember telling you, I was like, yeah, I'm out here on a job interview, basically. And as soon as I leave here, I'm going to Fieldcraft. And then I won the student shoot off and I felt like that was a sign. Like, I win the student shoot off, I go to Fieldcraft, I take the job at Fieldcraft, I leave public education, and you know, now I'm in the community more than ever. So Gunsight really is that place that I want people to understand. It's one of those institutions you got to go to. If you're really into firearms and firearms history, and I want to talk about history in just a hot second, you got to go to Gunsight, and there's an opportunity to win a class as long as you demonstrate some willingness. But yeah, it's funny that you've had Cagle, you've had me. Were you Luke's range master for that class?
I had Luke too.
Okay.
So we have Cagle corner on one of the ranges. David was being David one day, and I told him to go stand in the corner. He didn't understand what I talked about. I actually like pointed him to the corner and made him go stand there for a little bit. For those of you listening, right, this is it's not harassment or hazing. It's how you deal with the two Cagle boys. Sometimes you just have to take them back to high school. They are great kids. Great young men.
Yeah, and Cagle now joined the Army, so he's squared away with that. And his brother has gotten into like beast mode. Like when I first met him, he was kind of like, I don't think he was working out as much. I met him at the Modern Warrior Conference out in Oklahoma. And then I saw a picture of him recently, and like, he's always been into martial arts, but he ballooned up. Like he is a force right now.
Yeah, he is.
So the Cagle guys are out there, and I'm excited for you to meet my buddy, Jerry. Hopefully the stars align and you can be in the class or you'll be the instructor for Jerry. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about Gunsight, and I want to get to some shotgun stuff too, but I want to have a couple more questions about Gunsight. At the end of the 250 course, you get an opportunity to visit the sconce. And for those of you that are listening, the sconce is where Jeff Cooper lived. And there's a lot of cool things when you see the sconce. Like there's a tower. And when you look at the outdoor patio, there's a giant raven that was like a signal to the pilots that were flying in that you're over Gunsight. And, you know, Cooper had like architectural defense in mind with shooting ports, and like it was freaking amazing. And then his gun room, we only had a limited amount of time in the gun room. I took a video of the whole walk around because I was like, I need to watch this video multiple times. And you know, you're not allowed to pick up anything, but there's history everywhere, from the Steyr Scout on the wall to pistols to the knives he's collected. But the cool thing is that, oh, and by the way, you got to try the brownies. The brownies are legendary. But the cool thing about going there is that you learn the history of so many drills that as a shooting enthusiast or student, you might hear these terms, but you're like, well, where the heck does that come from? So Eric, I want to pick your brain and just kind of get the history from you as kind of our resident Gunsight history buff. Where does the failure drill come from? The two to the body, one to the head.
So this is one that you saw me nerd on in the class, because I think the history behind this is important because of how it's been portrayed in other places. So during the 70s, there were a lot of terrorist Bush wars in third world countries, communist backed insurgencies and stuff. One of them was in Mozambique. A guy by the name of Mike Rousseau gets attacked. My understanding is he's got a Browning high power in hand. He comes up, fires two shots. The guy who's charging at him lowers the gun to see if it had any effect. Bad guy's still coming. Rousseau comes up, tries to take a shot on the face, or what we would call a headshot. There's a bit of convulsiveness on the trigger, if not the whole pistol, and the shot goes into the neck. Bad guy goes down. Rousseau lives another day. He comes back to the States, has an interaction with Jeff Cooper, and Cooper initially refers to this as the Mozambique because of where it happens, and it was a controlled pair or a hammer, depending on the distance to the upper chest, lower the pistol, assess, and then go for a headshot if necessary. This is in the mid late 70s by this point. LAPD is getting ready to spin up for the 1984 Olympics. Several of the names in the law that are legendary in the law enforcement tactical community are going through Gunsight at that time as part of the lead up to the 84 Olympics. Two of them specifically were John Helms and Larry Mudgett from LAPD, both on D-platoon, their full-time SWAT team at the time. They took this back, looked at it, and they're like, the assessment pause is not going to work, right? This lowering the pistol to see if we've ended the fight is not going to work. So where the way that they determined it should be taught was a pair to the chest, reacquire the sights, and then immediately move the sights to the head. If the head was still there, then the plan was to take a deliberate headshot to end the fight. they called it the failure drill. It was a failure to stop drill, and took it back, had conversations with Jeff Cooper about it, and Jeff kind of approved that, and that ultimately became the teaching methodology. There is a deliberate assessment pause in there. That is the, I fired my shots, I now go for the head. If the head's no longer there, we're not taking the shot. If the head is there, it means that the shots to the body have failed and we need to solve the problem. It's not an execution technique or some of the other weird things I've heard it called. It wasn't done for drugs. It wasn't done for body armor. It was done because those initial shots to the body had failed and we needed to do something else.
You used a term that we also should clarify. You said a hammer. And recently, before we jumped on the podcast, I explained to you how I mentioned to an instructor recently where the term hammer and double tap comes from. So can you explain that quickly? Right.
So this was a little bit of back and forth based on 45 versus 9mm and some students who'd come to gun sight from across the pond. They've said, so the drill is the same regardless of the caliber. It is a sight picture, two shots delivered very quickly, and then reacquire the sights and reset the trigger, all those things going on. So it's a sight picture, two shots, reacquire, reset. They made the comment that it was a double tap and they were using 9mm. And the legend is that Jeff Cooper looked at him and said, well, here in America with a 45, we hammer them. So it was a hammer pair or a double tap, but it was one initial sight picture, two very quickly delivered shots back on the sights.
Understood. And, you know, and not to get into the caliber debates because it's more about placement, especially with modern ammo. Cooper had some very specific gear that he really enjoyed. And I think one of the cool things is when you go through that gun room, you see that he was a student of the firearm and he had multiple firearms, bolt action rifles, and he had, multiple types of pistols and revolvers and whatnot. Can you just talk to, because you've been in that gun room probably more than anyone I know, can you talk to some of the more interesting things that you've seen there or like, you know, some things that people might not know, because there are a lot of folks, like my buddy Mike Romano, you know, from Connecticut. He is the one that is a big fan of Cooper, and so many people are fans of what, you know, the late Colonel taught. Can you kind of talk about some of the equipment that he preferred?
Well, very much the 1911, but he also was into some other pistols, and like specifically the Bren 10. And when you walk in the door into the armory, the arms room, turn to the left, there's two Bren 10s there, right there. The number of different pistols, a lot of them are 1911 pattern guns. You talked about the Steyr Scout, but the Steyr Scout, now it's a couple generations ago, but in the late 80s, early 00s, when the Steyr Scout came into existence, it was about the fourth or fifth generation based on the scout rifle concept that Cooper had come up with and kind of pushed forward. It had been built by a number of different custom gunsmiths. Baby, which is a bolt action, short barreled, chambered in 460 guns and ammo, kind of a wildcat cartridge, is down there. There's collapsible stock H&K rifles. There's a number of different handguns, rifles, knives that Jeff acquired over the years, ammunition that Jeff acquired over the years, pictures, letters. There's hunting photos of Jeff's, gun sight instructors, of students of Jeff's that are all through there. There's one of the original J ladders. So you talked about the Friday afternoon shoot off, back when I first went, and kind of historically going back to the start of the school, the shoot offs, the school drills and shoot offs were shot on Saturday morning. And the shoot off was done on a thing called a J ladder, which was a double elimination, shoot competition. But that J ladder damn near took a master's in statistics to run, but there's some of those up on the walls. Originally, they're very different from the bouts, the way we run the shoot-offs now. Those are in there. I'm trying to think of some of the specific handguns that are in there without trying to dig through photos. Yeah. I would have done that. I know that was going to be a question.
So yeah, I'll tell you that whole sconce visit, I know we were trying to be very respectful to, you know, his family, who is very generous in opening it up and whatnot. I mean, if you have an opportunity to go, and the cool thing is, like, if you go to the Gunsight alumni shoot, which is every year, I won't be able to make it this year because we're running a course here in North Carolina. Otherwise, I would have booked a flight, because last year I won a Timney trigger. And I was so excited because it fit an AR that I was looking for a trigger for. But if you go to the Gunsight alumni shoot, the gas shoot, that's where I met Katie Pavlich from Fox News. I was in her heat. She was a podcast guest on here. They'll open up the sconce and just let you get a tour of it. And it's such a unique opportunity to see the gear that's out there. I'm definitely a fanboy of Gunsight, and, you know, I always promote it because I feel like it's an important part of my history and also the nation's history when it comes to, you know, learning defensive pistol. But speaking of defensive pistol, while I was there, you were the only one in our group. We had a class of, I think, 13, and then there was another 250 course that was running at the same time, a class of 12. But I think you were the only one in our group that had a red dot in your pistol. And you were saying, you know, all the virtues of the red dot and whatnot. And, you know, I wanted to podcast you because I just completed a 2-day red dot course with Glock, and I'm really understanding it better. You know, I dabbled with it for the past couple of years, and I had a working understanding of it, but now I have a much stronger understanding. And I really think that people need to experience it to realize at distance, it's a game changer. If you are cross-eye dominant, it's a game changer. Like, what was the reason for you migrating to the dot, and what are some of the reasons that you're still sticking with it? Because you're teaching red dot specific courses now there.
Yeah. So I shot competitively against guys in the 90s that were running dots on guns. They were the tube mounted optics that looked a lot more like the aim points on carbines than what we see now. And they were mounted to the frame. I put my first dot on a gun 2010. It was a little insights dot on a dovetail mount that you pounded out the old rear sight on a 1911, slid this in, torqued it, tightened it down, and then dropped the optic onto it. So 2010 was my first one. And I mentioned carbine. So if you think boreline sightline offset on an M4 with an aim point, it was about like that between the red dot and the barrel on a 1911. It was probably an inch plus. That was my first kind of foray into it. Realized that, like, hey, this has some merit. People were starting to talk about it. Guys like Gabe Spaulding was talking about Kelly McCann's experiences with it. And in 2011, I'm going, you know, we're going to see this at some point coming into law enforcement. So I got permission from my organization to run a dot for a year as a test. Mm-hmm. Wanted to see how it was going to work. So had an M&P in 9mm milled by Mark Housel down in Prescott Valley. We slapped a Trigicon RMR into it, Type 1, and spent a whole year working with it. A lot of things that I teach now, I didn't know them. We didn't know them. So we still tried to use the dot as a front sight. Again, this is 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. Made it through probably the first 2/3 of the year through August without much issue. Got to August, early September, started broke the first dot that was on the gun, and then broke several more, and I walked away from them for about 6 years at that point, 5.5, 6 years. Came back to them in 2018 when they'd gotten the reliability, the mechanical reliability up to the point where I was willing to try it again. 2019, I made the decision to retire from law enforcement. It was 29 years. And I got two projects dropped on me by Gunsight when I announced my retirement. One was to develop a red dot program for the school, and the other was to rewrite the student handbook. It had been a couple of years since it had been rewritten. And I really wanted to update it, bring some things like human factors and some other stuff into the book. So those were my two projects. We started teaching the dot classes down there the summer of 2020. So COVID hits and we're trying to teach something completely new. But I was fortunate. Gunsight let me take what we were seeing from people like Scott Jedlinski at Modern Samurai Project, Aaron Cowan at Sage Dynamics, the SIG Academy. Take some of my experiences and other people's experiences with the dots, and then make that work within the modern technique, within the doctrine that we were already teaching at the school. And I think we've had good success with that. There's going to be some purists I know who've told us that we're not teaching pure modern technique. We're not. Like, we're not focusing on the front sight. You're looking at the target or the threat and letting the dot appear. Yeah, that's different. But I think we've had a good successful program with it. We've been running the general pistol, the 250, and the intermediate pistol, the 350 dot classes. Now for a few years, next year, we're going to run an advanced pistol class, the 499, with a dot. And I'm looking forward to how we make that work, because it's not going to be, it's going to have some elements of the traditional 499, but we're also going to try to take that thing as far as we can.
You know, it's interesting, because when I first transitioned into shooting a dot on a pistol, I was doing exactly what you just talked about, like trying to find the front sight and then putting the dot on top of the front sight. I was like, oh, that's going to work, you know? And then recently this past week, the instructor said, if you're still looking for the front sight and you're not shooting the dot, then why don't you just shoot the front sights? Like, why, you know what I mean? And what you just said, where you don't aim the dot, you shoot the dot. It's just like the carbine. The dot appears, superimposes, but you stay target focused. So you're on one focal plane. And, you know, the technique that you're referencing, like Scott Jedlinski with like the guillotining, you know, like using it with kinesthetic alignment, like that type of thing is so smart. If you are up close, like you are aligned, let it rip, let it go. You're not going to miss your target at a closer range. You don't have to necessarily superimpose that dot because you have another way of properly aiming. I mean, all of this is groundbreaking stuff, but you know, the dot is so interesting to me because it's the game changer at distance. And, you know, for years it was always 3 yards, 3 rounds, 3 seconds, right? Like everyone would say like, oh, that's where most shootings happen. But unless you think you're that lucky, why aren't you training to take that 25 yard shot or the 50 yard shot? Like that kid, what was his name? Kyle Dickens, who responded to the mall shooter, he put 8 rounds on a dude, 8 out of 10 rounds at 40 yards. Like that kid trains, and I'm pretty sure he did it with a dot.
My understanding was iron sights.
Real, even more impressive.
Dots, but I haven't had it confirmed. There were a series of engagements in that shooting. He shot, moved, shot, moved, shot, moved.
Okay.
So it wasn't all the shots back at 40.
But still, the fact that he took a shot, you know, at 40,
it was an amazing performance, right?
Oh,
regardless,
for sure.
It was an amazing performance. One of the things we do in the dot classes, you've been through Monday morning with the classroom stuff where we're talking about the fundamentals and the foundational stuff. One of the things we do in the dot classes, and we're pushing it out to all the other ones as well, because we've got so many students coming through with dots, is what changes and what stays the same. There's a bunch of mythology out there about Weaver. What I said when I read the student handbook is Weaver's contribution to shooting was getting two hands on the gun and bringing the sights to eye level. It wasn't so much what he was doing with the elbows or anything else. But I hit that because your platform, your stance, the starting point for where you're going to be, because the events I've been involved in were not textbook standing strong foot slightly back, support side foot slightly forward. None of them were standing stationary. Mm-hmm. But your platform doesn't change, right? Your grip on the pistol doesn't change. Your trigger manipulation doesn't change just because you go to a dot. But what we found is that your visual attention, your focus changes because you're not looking at the front sight. You're looking at the threat. You're looking at the target and letting the dot appear. Your presentation, how the gun comes from the holster to intersecting your line of sight, or comes from a ready position to intersecting your line of sight, is going to change. And then the iron sights, because of their size, kind of whisper to you about what you're doing to the gun. Mm-hmm. The dot freaking screams at you about what you're doing to the gun. When you see that dot start to streak across the glass, up, down, left, right, low corner, whatever, it's telling you what you're inputting into that gun with your trigger manipulation, with your grip, with your support hand. And it gives you a lot better feedback on it. And that feedback will carry over to shooting iron sights in a way that irons don't necessarily carry over to shooting the dots.
It's very true with dry fire, you know, and
yeah.
You know, one of the funny things about dry fire is the scariest place to be is a hotel in a city where a shooting competition is taking place, because all the out of town competitors are shooting at light switches and their TV and whatnot. So like, you know, dry fire is one of those things that people need to do. And you know, I think there's diminishing returns with dry fire. Like give it good 10 to 15 minutes of your strict attention, look what that's doing. But when you shoot a dot with dry fire, like you said, it will let you know when you press that trigger, is the dot moving to the left violently? Or is that dot just kind of doing that acceptable figure eight or infinity sign and then staying stationary? Like dry fire is so important, but people don't understand it. They think, oh, I'm just going to press a trigger. Okay, I got the trigger down. I got the reset down. But it's really about keeping those sights steady. And like, what are some of your favorite takeaways from dry fire practice? Like, what are some golden nuggets you can pass on to someone?
So you talked about shortened down to 10 to 15. I got some input about a year ago from one of the firearms instructors down at Phoenix. I'm down to 5 minutes, three times a week.
No kidding.
When I do it. Just 5 minutes. It's because it's more recency with time on the gun than duration of time.
That's a great point.
When you start telling folks you got to do 25, 30 minutes, they may do that once every couple of weeks, but people can find time to do 5 minutes a few times a week. So I will work when I do it, my kind of process is I work the presentation in reverse. So rather than coming from the holster all the way up, I will start with the pistol just off target. Mm-hmm. Bring it into the eye target line. So I'm acquiring the dot. Then I come down to where my hands meet up, and then I'll work from both a ready position and the holster, working on acquiring the dot. And then from there, I'm going into either multiple target drills, lateral transitions, changing aiming points. So something along the line of a failure drill, working from a larger aiming point to a smaller aiming point, either laterally or vertically. I'm looking to see what my grip input does to the gun. I'm looking to see, is my presentation still sufficient to get that dot in the eye target line to where I'm not having to move the gun. I'm not having to try to fish for it. And don't fish for the dot. If the dot's not there, well, you're trying to learn the process of it. Leave the gun where it is, move the head, find the dot, and then figure out where that needs to be. When people talk about it being slower, it's because they're trying to fish for that dot and move the gun all over the place. And a lot of it's what I'm looking at is what the input is between the hands and the trigger manipulation. It's not the trigger press that's moving the gun all over. It's what the hands are doing, but I'm trying to minimize adverse impacts on that and then just work my transitions.
Yeah. I think I could easily keep, you know, just fishing for questions from you. Like just, what about this? What about this? Like I could just go on and on and on about the red dot, but you're not just,
on the dot,
yeah. Go ahead.
One thing real quick to hit is occluded optic work.
Yes.
If you're having, so one of the benefits of the dot is it really gets you to where you can shoot with both eyes open, which gives you better visual input. It's the way we see the world in general anyway. If you're having difficulty with that, or if you're still working on picking up the dot on the presentation, painter's tape over the downrange lens. I use blue painter's tape. I've talked to folks in the federal government who like the gray painter's tape for whatever reason. If that's what you have, rock on with it. But just tape over the downrange lens, work your presentations. I can't remember, we had done the occluded optic work with aim points on carbines in the OOs. And I'm not sure how I picked it up and brought it over to the pistol, but the feedback from students has been is that it has been extremely helpful. And I know there's other folks who advocate for it. You can do some or a little. What I'll generally do with gun sight during that is once we show it to them, they'll get runs on the school drills, kind of the school standards, twice a day once they've seen that, just to help them with that, right? So I would work occluded optic work into either your dry practice or your live fire. Unless you're one of the about 10 to 12% who have a thing called phoria, which is an optical wiring issue, where it's just for whatever reason, there's a wiring connection that was missed. And the brain can't put the two separate images together, the image from the dominant eye seeing the dot and the image from the weak eye seeing the target. The brain doesn't always put them together in the right way. So if you're one of those, then once you figure it out, disregard. But for those who it works for, I found it to be extremely beneficial.
Yeah, that blue tape is something else. We did that recently on that class. We did it initially for the you know, the downrange optic to show that we're using that binocular vision, but then they move that tape to the rear. So you couldn't see the dot at all. And then that's when we did the, that's when we did the guillotine work on the target lining up with the collarbone. And the instructor was like, yeah, some of the guys have even gotten to the point. These are students where they're taking like a silver Sharpie and they're outlining the top of their red dot. And then they're also putting horizontal lines on the side or on the top, where when you do present the pistol, if it's not perfectly square, you'll see the horizontal line on the side. That's what their logic was. And for me, I found I was using a 509T and a Holosun 509T. And the instructor was like, if you can see the on off buttons on the side, your pistol screwed up, like straighten out that wrist, you know? And it was so interesting, like just hearing it a different way. And sometimes you just need to hear someone else tell you, because everyone thinks that they're a cool guy in their head until someone's like, you're screwed up, you know, fix yourself. But
that was one of the things was how to, addressing people's concerns about optic failure or optics blocking. I've taught a block the last couple of years at the Rangemaster Tactical Conference down in Dallas on specifically the broken and blocked optics. And, you know, nobody having invented anything, when we start talking about like the guillotine method, Aaron Cowan showed me the paint pen mark on top, which gives you a vertical indicator. Like if all of a sudden you can see more and more of that paint pen mark, you're really throwing your muzzle high on it. But also goes back to Jim Cirillo's stuff. Cirillo, if you read the stories of the Stakeout Squad and the stuff that Jim Cirillo did, he wasn't necessarily using the front sight, rear sight. He was using the shape of the gun as his sighting system. So if he came up, presented the pistol, the hammer was going to be about where the front sights would be. And if he could see the cylinder, that, you know, more of the cylinder to one side or the other, he knew the gun was offset. He was looking for the hammer. And I'll screw up the revolver terminology, but the back plate that protects the rounds in the cylinder, right? When he saw that in front of him with no indication left or right, he knew he was on target. Well, that's one of the ways we teach the broken blocked optic stuff, is using what Cirillo taught.
That's when you just know you're dealing with someone who's a gunfighter at that point, when they're like, I pointed the pistol at the person and I knew that it was on, you know, like, it wasn't Wyatt Earp or who was it who said, how did you take that 100-yard revolver shot? And this is like with a single action arm. And he said, I just pointed it at him and shot. I'm trying to think who that was. Was that Wyatt Earp or who was it? I know one of the listeners is going to probably chime in.
I don't remember that being attributed to Earp, but that's probably a question Dave Spaulding could answer.
How'd you take that 100-yard shot? Well, I pointed my pistol at him and I fired. Again, we could talk about handguns all day, but I really wanted to talk to you too, because I'm just as much of a shotgun nerd as the next guy. And we recently started teaching shotgun classes here at Fieldcraft. Jerry is our head instructor. I've gone through, you know, shotgun courses with Kenny Stretz and Sig Academy. I'm going to get to Gunsight at some point and take that one, because that's, you know, on my bucket list. But we have very similar tastes with shotguns, Vancomp porting. I know you're a big fan of Beretta shotguns, but you do this thing called the Thunder Stick. And this intrigues me. And I'm ticked off that I did not black out my calendar for that weekend, because I would absolutely have gone there this year if I wasn't teaching. But talk to me about this Thunder Stick thing, because I know people who have gone to it and they're like, you need to go. So let's talk about shotguns. What is Thunder Stick?
So Thunder Stick Summit was kind of the creation of Daryl Bulkey, along with a few others of us, to spend time really working on ensuring that the lore of the shotgun sticks around, that how it's used, how it's taught, that sticks around and it doesn't go away. And it grew out of what Daryl and some other guys, Wayne Dobbs, did with the revolver, the Pat Rogers revolver roundup. So last year, down in Dallas, it was Tom Givens, Daryl Bulkey, Steve Fisher, Robin, Matt Hott, and myself did the inaugural run, the inaugural Thunder Stick Summit. How did I get asked? Good question. I was fortunate that I came up on the shotgun by exposure to it in West Coast law enforcement, especially California, where it was a very popular tool when I was coming up. But I been taught the shotgun by Scotty Reitz at LAPD, Bill Jeans, Louis Auerbach. When I came on staff at Gunsight, I was fortunate to do to have been involved in doing a lot of the shotgun classes over the years, that I'm back to doing a fair amount of the shotgun stuff. I do it in the private sector. I do it with my company, so as well as at Gunsight. Anyway, so back to the Thunderstick. We put it together. We ran a test bed one with a few students, 25 down at Dallas Pistol Club. This year, Van Comp is going to host the event out in Las Vegas, October 20th, 21st, 22nd out there. And it's going to be, Tom Givens is not going to be able to make it because it's too far west of Texas, and Tom doesn't go west of Texas right now. So it will be Daryl, Steve Fisher, myself, Robin, Matt Hott, Mark Fricky. I apologize, I can't remember the name of Mark's company, but he also teaches a lot of law enforcement centric training for a national organization. He just doesn't want to identify the organization. And then I believe Greg Elifritz is going to be teaching as well. Greg's active response training, I think, is Greg's company. So we'll be doing 3 days out there. Fisher and I are going to team up Saturday night to do a low light shotgun block, specific to running the gun in low light. And then we'll have all sorts of other things, movement, the HOTS push-pull, recoil management, their short stocking, manipulations of the gun, looking at it from both the East and West Coast perspectives, because there are some kind of different differences between the two coasts on that. We've also got guys out of the center of the country, Elifritz, and there's kind of even a difference there on how the gun was run. I came up on the Remington because it was a department issue weapon, and it, for the longest time, it had a really good reputation. With the advent of the Beretta 1301s, I've migrated to those as my primary of choice. And over the last probably 4 years, I've really come to like the Mossbergs for a pump shotgun. I really like the Mossberg. That said, the first thing I'm going to grab if I have my choice is probably going to be my Beretta. I'm really happy with my 1301s.
Yeah, I'm running my Beretta 1301 tomorrow at this class. You know, I've got it somewhat pimped out. Like, I did the Magpul forend. I did the whole Aridus thing, which, you know, people have said, well, how do you like it? I broke my first Aridus forend because my Surefire light broke the front M-lock section. Yep. But they replaced it. I just had to mill it in. And I've got I'm going to put my RMR on that one so I can run the RMR with the 1301. But that gun has been fantastic. And you mentioned a method, the push-pull, the Rob Hott push-pull, which is that's how I was brought up. And I was always an 870 guy. Like, that was my first shotgun as a bird hunter. And I had my Remington Police 870 for the longest time. And then I went to 590 A1. But then Beretta has been good. They sent Jerry and I a couple shotguns each. So we're screwing around with the 1301 and the A300, the Patrol. And that Patrol, man, I'll tell you know, 1301 is the Ferrari. Like, there's no doubt about it. Like, that is a phenomenal shotgun, but that A300 is kind of like, maybe not the Ferrari, but maybe like a Lotus. like it's a sexy car, but not quite at Ferrari level, but it's still a hell of a performer for what you get out of the box. You mentioned push pull, but one time I put up a video on IG and you were like, yeah, push pull works great. Sometimes pull works. Can you talk about that instance? Because I think people don't understand. Yep. Like, they think, oh, shotgun, it's going to knock you on your ass. And it's like, if you know how to handle it, it doesn't. In fact, you can shoot it quickly, but push-pull is known. But what about pull-pull?
So Rob and Matt, especially Rob, developed, I think probably to hear him tell the story, it almost sounds like it was a subconscious thing. He just figured out this made sense, trying to break the gun apart right before you break the shot, by pushing forward on the forearm while pulling back on the grip with the shooting hand. It works. I have no problem doing it with a semi-auto shotgun. I can do that with a semi-auto all day long. I have heard from a couple of folks that there's one or two models of semi-autos out there because of their operating system, it doesn't work as well. But with any semi-auto I've run, Rob's push-pull works extremely well. That said, as a guy who came up as a pump gun shooter, I was taught the pull-pull. Mm-hmm. So you're pulling the stock back into the shoulder and you're lightly loading the forearm of the gun so that when you break the shot, as you start to come back under recoil and the gun's unlocking, you're already running the action rearward. And then as you come out of recoil, you're running the action back forward. Regardless of which way works best for you, both of them are light years better than pressing the trigger, taking the physical hit from the recoil, which isn't bad, but psychologically, I know it has some impact, and then trying to mechanically run the gun afterwards.
I got a funny feeling what drives you crazy is when guys break the cheek weld and then they pump it like Sarah Connor in Terminator 2, right? Not necessarily a one-handed, but like they bring it in front of them into their workspace. They pump the shotgun. They get a new cheek weld, take the fire, take the shot, break the cheek weld, pump it. Like that drives me up a wall. It's like that gun, you can manipulate the forend while it's still in your shoulder, still on the center of your chest, wherever you decide to put it. Like, why are you doing that?
It's not that it drives me crazy, but it's going to be a paternal conversation. Come here, son. Let's have a chat.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
Because you're wasting time, one. Two, you're taking both the physical and the psychological hit of the recoil and not getting anything out of it. Right? And it's incredibly inefficient, versus I can keep that regardless of what operating system I'm using and what system I use to manage the recoil physically. If I can keep that stock in the pocket of the shoulder, stay on the sights and run the gun, I'm going to be able to end that fight a whole lot sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The fun thing with a shotgun, like people want to discredit it and they're going to say like, you know, why would I carry a shotgun? The AR is so much better, but there are some municipalities and jurisdictions where you cannot own AR-15. And even as a woodsman traveling to the backcountry, give me a shotgun loaded with 1 ounce slugs, full power slugs. And that's my preferred bear gun. Like I know that I can run that thing. It's reliable. Like for me, reliability is everything. Like that is, or I shouldn't say everything, but it's my priority. Like it's one of the reasons why I'm a big Glock advocate. I know that gun's going to run. I'll still be trained in case it doesn't, if there's a malfunction, whatever, but reliability matters. Pump guns, slugs, they stop things. Something that we're going to do, just because I don't think students realize it. Like you said, that recoil is sometimes a shock. There's no doubt in my mind that a 3.5 inch turkey load recoils more than a 1 ounce slug and a 2 3/4 inch shell. So tomorrow Jerry's got some turkey loads. He brought out his Ulti Mag and we're going to let the students, if they want, experience the recoil from a turkey load. And that's just for giggles. Like we're going to let it rattle their teeth. But then it's going to be 88 degrees here, like super high humidity. We're going to break out gallon jugs of water, and that's going to be how we're going to let students cool off. We're going to let them shoot a gallon jug of water with a buckshot round at maybe a yard away and just cool off that way. I mean, hey, it's America. That's how we do things. One of the questions
you mentioned.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to jump in. You mentioned at the start of our conversation about like what would be a red flag on an instructor.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I saw this in the academy. It has been done, unfortunately, far too many times. Don't take someone who's new to the shotgun and load a full power Magnum slug in it and hand it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Before they, and it's more of a push. The recoil isn't going to pick you up and launch you, because it's not going to pick up and launch the other dude when you hit him. That's just physics, right? It's an equal and opposite reaction. But the physical and initial psychological effect of taking somebody who doesn't know what they're going to do, who's already got it in their head that this shotgun's all powerful and might beat on them, and then you give them a full power load to start off with and they don't know what's going on. And unfortunately, I see people do it on video, usually to gals. Don't do that. Yeah. What you guys are talking about is different, because they're going to know what's going on. I'm talking about a student, somebody who's never picked up a shotgun
before. Right. Yeah, I did that to a college buddy, but this is a friend who was like, dude, this thing's awesome. I bet it kicks like crazy. And he already shot at a bunch. I'm like, I'll give you a round that kicks. And I didn't tell him which round in the tube it was. And I have the video of it. It's my buddy Jay Strohmeyer. He's a good kid. He's like 6'4 and 240. So he could handle it. But he looked back at me after he shot that round. He's like, wow. I won't do that to a green student, but if someone's really like, this thing's not so bad, it's not so bad, what else do you got? It's like, okay, I'll always say, do you want to feel it? You know, but I agree. Like that's one of those things. I don't know what it is in the gun community. Like people want to hand off either the shotgun, or even worse yet, are like these little Alaskan Smith & Wesson, 500 Smith & Wesson Magnum revolvers. And it's like, here, you want to shoot this for the first time? And they let them shoot it. And then next thing you know, they bury the front sight in their forehead. That can be a dick move. I see that. One of the things I want to ask you quickly, we're running short on time. I got to meet up with a former student here for lunch. But when I was there last, I remember Gary Smith, who was my instructor for the 270 rifle. He said that some cops from California have been going through with lever guns because they're finding that their jurisdiction, but their PD is saying, like, look, for perception, you guys can carry these lever guns. That there's some truth to that, right?
I don't know about law enforcement doing it, but that was historically, we were using lever gun rifles.
Yeah.
As well as some of the other rifles in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. It was only, it seems to be after the 50s that law enforcement migrated to shotguns.
Gotcha.
Just think that was a cultural thing. Anyway, going back to the specific stuff, current environment, there's a lot to be said for using a long gun mm-hmm. that doesn't have the negative perceptions that some people associate with that some people associate with the AR. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but there's media driven stuff and there's politically driven stuff. And if you could be in an event that you could end with a few rounds with a gun that's not going to create a bunch of drama, you and your agency and your community might be a lot better off.
I think that's why Mossberg came out with that patrol rifle, right? Where it was kind of like a bolt action that took AR mags. And there, a lot of these companies are doing basically like the Steyr Scout, but their version where it's like Ruger Gunsight Scout, you know, and it's a long gun. It's a 30 caliber round and it, no one is going to scoff at the 308. And that's why I love the whole idea of the scout rifle for the average American who might be traveling across country. It's a great travel gun because it looks like a hunting rifle. And granted, Cooper's idea was that, you know, this is a firearm that can end a gunfight very quickly with a well-placed shot, you know, first round hit. And it's also something that does a little bit of everything. And I know with like low power variable optics, AR-15s are at the door of like where the scout rifle can be, because many of those scout rifle scopes are like 2-6 or 1-4 or whatever, but there's something to be said about that 308 caliber or the 6.5 caliber and, you know, a true bolt action rifle that doesn't have a lot of moving parts, the simplicity of it, again, reliability. You know, I love my Steyr Scout. I'm so happy that I took the class with it because I'm confident in it. And that's accompanied me to trips to Colorado where, again, AR-15s are looked down upon in Colorado because of the theater shooting out there and all that stuff. Yep. So, you know, it's a sad world that we live in where we have to think like that. But, you know, the consequence of not thinking like that is getting into a serious bind. And then next thing you know, what are the second and third order effects? Your family gets impacted by you not being around. Your job suffers. Like you gotta be smart with your decisions, you know?
Unfortunately, we're in a place where you don't just have to deal with the criminal justice system. You may have to deal with the civil system. And then there's a third court, the one of public opinion, that can very significantly end up driving the other two.
Right.
And that's kind of a whole separate topic, right? If you can end these events sooner with fewer rounds, you're going to be light years better off.
Yeah. So get some training, right?
Yes.
So what I like doing at the end of every podcast is I like doing some like rapid fire questions. And then I want you to tell people where they can go to train with you, to follow you, and all that. So if you're up for it, I got about five questions, rapid fire questions for you. And just give me like a quick, like sub 10 second response. And, you know, we'll see how you do with these, if you're up for it.
All right. Send it.
All right. First one, what is your everyday carry?
M&P 4-inch shield out of the performance center with a hollow sun optic on it.
Okay. So just pistol. Carry some other stuff though, right? Flashlight and all that.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought we were talking about the gun. Yeah. I've got a little Gerber folding knife, Purefire Stiletto Pro there. And then usually some sort of high end, analog watch.
Okay. Second question. Who is the better shooter, Luke or David Cagle? Oh, no, you don't have to answer that one. I'm just messing with you.
I would say David. Mm-hmm. Luke has a physicality about him that's beyond David's in terms of the martial arts. David spent more time behind the gun, and he also has the benefit now of experience, mm-hmm. and how that drives the importance of training.
Okay, spot on. What is your favorite range that you have ever shot on?
It no longer exists, unfortunately, but it was the qualification range at Fort Ord across from the Black Horse Golf Club. It was a 300-meter range on both sides of a ravine with chamise brush that grew up in front of the pop-up targets, and it grew back very quickly, so you actually had to work to find the targets.
Okay. When I saw you at the Gunsight alumni shoot, you had on a flowered shirt. What is the story behind your flowered shirt that you had on at the Gunsight alumni shoot? And I believe there might have been a moose on there.
Oh, so, okay. That was like Pat. I was trying to think of which one it was. That was probably the Pat Rogers shirt. So yeah, it was the Pat Rogers shirt. Gunsight alumni who live in the area have divided up into like the Paul Denises and the Chino Valley irregulars. Several of the folks were students of Pat, or were students of those of us who were students of Pat. And they put together a Hawaiian print shirt to honor Pat. Pat had an award that he referred to as the moose cock. It was a picture of a Bowwinkle moose and a rooster. He gave that award out to students who had manipulation or other performance issues. It was based on his concern about people making sure that they got the magazine seated in an AR correctly, which was done by push-pull. He likened that to how one might entertain a moose. I don't know how G, PG, or R-rated this show will be. I will cut off the explanation at that point.
You know, I had a fifth question lined up. I completely lost it because I always knew that it was referred to as that, but I didn't realize that it referred to what it might look like. So I don't even remember that fifth question right now, dude. I can't even tell you. But I'll say this. We'll save that fifth question for the next time we have coffee or something like that. But I will say this, and I'll close with the story, and then I want people to know where they can find you. The coolest thing for me, when I was a student with you, you know, obviously like everyone's going around, you know, we hit it off because you were a magazine writer, I'm a magazine writer. And the coolest thing for me was, you know, we did the student shoot off. We had the three guys, the father and the two sons, Team Wilson. And, you know, we had some 1911 shooters. We had a couple cops. Like, we had a good group in that bunch. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we did the student shoot off where it was like one target at, I think, 5 yards, one target at, I think, 15. And then the other split, you know, down the center. And I had won the student shoot off on our side. And then you're like, oh, but there's another 250 class. We're going to go over there. And it was so cool walking over there. And I don't know if you remember this, but there was one gal that was in that shooting class, an older woman. And she comes up to me and she's like, oh, you're so this. And I was like, I'm just coming here to shoot. Like, let's shoot. So we went over there and I shot off against the other student, and she starts changing her tune once she realizes that class is losing. And, you know, I end up winning the overall thing. And, you know, I turned around, I had a couple choice words for her, like, what were you saying? Something like that. But then the coolest thing was when all the awards were given out, it was getting that, having my name called last, you know, and you had shuffled the papers around. So you call my name last and you gave me that silver raven. And like I said, at the very beginning of the podcast, that experience kind of was a signal to me, like, I'm in the wrong career. I shouldn't just be teaching at the high school. I need to join this Fieldcraft crew. And that was one of the coolest experiences I've had at Gunsight. Like, that's my Gunsight moment, was winning that student shoot off, 25 shooters, and then getting that pin. That to me, like, hands down, of all the experiences, and, you know, I did it again at the 270, but that initial one against 25 students, that was freaking awesome. And I'm just so happy that, you know, I had a chance to do that. It was so cool to get it from you. You know, and that's what I'm always going to remember about the Academy.
Very cool.
So let's talk about where people can find you in case they want to train with you. You know, maybe someone is going to look up you know, older single women looking for younger guys. But where can people find you? Maybe, you know, deliberately instead of accidentally.
Yes, deliberately. So CougarMountainSolutions.com is the website. I can be found on the Book of Faces or Instagram, some variation of Cougar Mountain Solutions, either all one word or underscore between the words. Like we've talked about a bunch, I teach at Gunsight. I've taught there for 22 years now. I write for AmericanCop.com. It's part of the Firearms Media Group. So American Handgunner, Guns Magazine, and American Cop, but American Cop's online only. I think I've got some stuff coming out in Shot On in the near future. We're going to do a series of the evolution of pistol mounted optics over there. I just did some shotgun stuff for them.
Very cool. Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I really hope you guys that have been listening will follow him. And until next time, thank you so much for listening.